I just want to make sure, too, everybody got the packet on Friday.
Yes, I took a look at it.
Yep, I got it as well.
Great. Okay, so I'm going to call this meeting to order. So the first line of business is approval of the minutes.
I looked at those, and they're what I remember, so I'll move to adopt the minutes. Doug?
This is Josh. I had one minor correction or clarification that I think it refers to my having referred to the transcript. I don't remember what I actually said, but I meant to refer to the minutes.
Pardon me, but to be technical, we should second it before we discuss it. I'm trying to keep things in order. Sorry.
Well, I will second the motion.
Okay.
Great. So it's moved and seconded. Now, Josh, you have an amendment to the minutes.
Yeah, and I forgot exactly what language I used at the meeting, but I meant to refer to the minutes. The minutes currently have me as referring to the transcript, so I just want to clarify that.
Which part of the minutes is that in? And
Josh, can you just give us a little bit more guidance on where that is?
I see it. It's right under the first discussion, second paragraph. Josh asked what criteria was used to determine interest rates. Is that it?
No.
No, it's
keep
not.
Going up. Higher page, right there.
Oh, asked if written transcripts of the board meetings. Did you mean written minutes?
Yeah.
Great.
All right. Sorry, Josh.
All right.
Wait a minute. Excuse me. We do have written minutes. This is written minute.
Right. Right. But he was asking if written minutes were necessary.
All right. All right. No,
so.
It is not necessary.
Okay.
I was just pointing out that the minutes currently use the phrase, I think, written transcripts.
Yep.
And I think I was referring to written minutes.
Yep. I think that can just be an editorial change. I don't think we need to vote on that unless we feel like we need to.
I agree.
Great. Okay. Any other amendments or changes since that was minor? It's more of a grammatical. Okay. So we've approved the minutes?
All in favor of aye, I vote yes.
Great.
I vote yes.
So the minutes have been approved. Moving on to approval of the loan. So, Rich, do you just want to give us an overview of
sure.
That?
It appears there are seven loans up for approval with a total of about $5.3 million. Nothing extraordinary. The Town of Beloit loan, which is the majority of the packet, is really just going to be an extension of a prior loan for about 60 days. They're getting taken out. This was a loan for a sewer project, and they were expected to be taken out by the Clean Water Fund from the Department of Administration upstairs. And there was a delay in that process because of some employee turnover in that group upstairs, and so they just needed an extension for a few months. Our minimum loan term here is 2 years, and so we extended it for 2 years at the 4.25%. Everything else is pretty standard.
All right, this is Doug. I'll move adoption or approval of the seven loans.
Is there a second?
I second.
So it's been approved and seconded. So all those in favor of approving the loans for March 5th, say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Josh.
Hi, Sarah. So the loans are approved. Now moving on to old business. So just to jog everybody's memory, a couple weeks ago we went through policies that had been previously kind of put in place by the last board, and the two that were remaining that we were waiting for guidance from the BCPL staff was on the out-of-state travel, and then also with regards to prohibiting staff from lobbying. So, Tom, do you want to walk us through this, or Jonathan, do you want to walk us through this?
With respect to the travel policy, it was my understanding that the board at the last meeting had roughed out the rough parameters of a new travel policy and had asked the board to, in essence, reduce that to writing for the board then to consider for adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is. And so, in essence, it's got 4 points that the executive secretary would have to approve travel for all of staff for out-of-state travel. But for the executive secretary and any commissioner, that would have to be approved by the board chair. Any of those expenses would still have to be reasonable and necessary and in accordance with the state compensation plan. And also, if that out-of-state travel for any particular event would exceed the $5,000 limit that the board had kept in place from the previous meeting, that would require approval from the board chair as well. So in essence, dovetailing this policy with the $5,000 limit that was approved at the prior meeting.
Okay, this is Doug. Do we need a motion, or do we just say that's fine?
Motion.
I think you can make a motion, Doug.
I was asking our attorney if we need to have a motion. Tom?
Well, the Attorney General is the chief attorney for the state of Wisconsin, but in my opinion, it would be a good idea to have him to have this moved and seconded.
Okay. In that case, this is Doug. I'll move we adopt this this new clarification of our out-of-state travel.
This is Josh. I'll second, but I would like to discuss two parts of this.
Yep, so moved in second and done.
We are able to discuss now, right?
Yep.
One is, I just want to make sure that the language is clear. I believe it's point three, that the travel that we are referring to is travel on behalf of BCPL or in connection with, BCPL duties specifically and not in connection with other state agency duties.
That's an interesting question. I think it sort of goes without saying, but because the three of us all have other responsibilities, we might travel as Secretaries of State or Attorney Generals. I don't know if it needs to be clarified, but if you would like, we can do that.
In points one and two, it specifically says agency business travel, but the Attorney General is correct that I had been a little bit lazy in number three and said just such travel expenses instead of saying agency business travel expenses. So that's perfectly acceptable to change such to say agency business.
Could we actually change agency business to BCPL business travel?
Sure.
Yeah.
In all of the sections?
So it would read that requires BCPL travel be reasonable and necessary for number three, and for number four, requires board chair approval for such BCPL travel expenses.
Yeah, and I think I would also change one and two. So it says instead of out-of-state agency business travel, it says out-of-state BCPL business travel.
Yep. Done.
Okay. So the amendment is to basically where it says out of state agency business to say BCPL business travel for 1, 2, 3, and 4. Any other discussion on that amendment?
I presume Josh made that, and if he made that amendment, I'll second it.
Great. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of approving the amendment, say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Josh. And to be clear, my understanding is it will say in each of them, out-of-state BCPL business travel.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Does that have to be changed?
Great.
All right, and then the second thing I was...
Yep.
The second a point of amendment I was going to suggest is right now it says, as I understand point two right now, it would have the board chair approving the board chair's travel, and I think it just is a good government matter is appropriate to have, you know, whether it's the other two commissioners or one of the other two commissioners, but having someone else approve the travel?
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
I think that's appropriate, Josh, but it might be simplest just to say that in the case of the board chair, that the board itself will have a passive review, meaning that it would be just reported to the next board meeting. Typically, travel takes place some weeks after it's been approved in any case. Well, there's just a notification.
So another option would be to have the executive secretary approve it, which I would be comfortable with. I don't know if
all right,
you all are.
I see.
Mr. Doug, I don't have this in front of me. I apologize. So I don't quite understand the question.
I'll read it to you, Doug.
The board chair. Pardon me. Go ahead.
I can read the item. Requires the executive secretary and any commissioner to obtain approval for his or her out-of-state travel from the board chair, and then requires that This is number one.
There'd be a new number three.
It's point two currently. One of the implications of that is just that the board chair is approving the board chair's travel.
No. That's correct. We can change that.
So you could add to point one, just requires every BCPL staff member and the commission and the board chair. Or Sarah, if you have thoughts on a better way to do that, I don't have a strong view.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that in my experience, the board approves the chair's travel, not the, like, CEO or whoever. It's always the board.
That does make sense.
So I think that it would be, in my mind, another point that would just be that the board chair receives approval from the commissioners with their travel. It would just be a new point.
Could we just do that? I think that makes more sense than a passive review process, only because that way there's a ability to approve it in advance.
Right.
So if I have this correct, it requires the board chair to obtain approval for his or her out-of-state BCPL business travel from the board.
Yeah. Does that?
I mean, we should make that the rule for all three commissioners. If you, either way, is fine with me.
Clear what's always used to be.
All right. If that's an amendment, I'll move the adoption of that amendment.
I will second it, but basically the amendment says that the board chair will receive approval from the board with regards to BCPL travel.
I think he added the board chair or any commissioner will receive board approval.
Sounds good.
Meaning it'll go to the next board meeting and they can approve it. It's a little cumbersome, but better than me approving it.
Okay, so we now have a different discussion point, which I just want to point out. So what Jonathan was
did we approve that or not? I don't think so.
No, it wasn't.
I made a motion to approve this amendment.
Yeah, I don't think there's been a second, Doug.
So we're not going to do that, okay?
Well, because it goes... So if we can just take a point of information for 1 second. So the amendment actually is not that just the board chair, but basically the commissioners will receive approval from the board with regard to travel. Just
right.
All of us, not just the board chair. So that's what it seems like the discussion has led to this amendment.
I think that makes sense. So the commissioners need approval from the board for all out-of-state BCTL travel.
Yes.
So if I can summarize, point number two gets amended to strike commissioner. So number two would just read, requires the executive secretary to obtain approval for his or her out-of-state BCPL business travel from the board chair. And then there'd be a new number three that requires any board member to obtain approval for his or her out-of-state BCPL business travel from the board. And then current number three and number four would slide into number four and number five.
That makes sense to me. Any points of clarification from what Tom just read with the new amendment?
That sounds correct to me as well. I was noting as you were reading that, Tom, that points one and two, and this relates to my point earlier, but I realized I assume that any agency business travel for BCPL folks would be BCPL travel, but I don't think that's worth worrying about unless anybody sees an issue with that language.
I think that's fine to just say it that way.
So we have a motion and a second, I think, right?
Yeah, so it's been moved and seconded for the amendment that says basically board or commissioners will get approval from travel from the commission.
Yep.
So all those in favor say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Josh.
Aye, Sarah. So the amendment has been approved. Any other discussion with regards to the out-of-state travel policy? Great. So if there is no other discussion, all those in favor of passing the out-of-state travel policy as is, say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Josh.
Aye, Sarah. So the out-of-state travel policy is approved. Thank you.
My God, I can't believe that. We spent 4 hours on this.
All right. Okay. Wow, we're just keep it rolling. Let's go to the next point, which is the lobbying by agency staff. So, Tom, do you want to provide an overview on this policy, please?
Sure. The previous board had adopted sort of a blanket policy against lobbying. And staff were not allowed to lobby the legislature, the governor's office, or the federal government, but lobbying was not explicitly defined in the policy, but one of the commissioners defined lobbying as talking to. So in essence, it was, for all intents and purposes, a gag order on any staff member talking to virtually anybody. And so what I tried to do is capture the responsibilities of staff members with respect to the positions of the board. And I tried to lay that out in two bullet points. And after those two bullet points, trying to put any further restrictions on it starts running afoul of constitutional protections for freedom of speech and freedom of petitioning the government. So, that's what I tried to do here.
Well, I looked at it, and it seems sensible, so I'll move we adopt that.
Is there a second?
I second. I just want to make sure I understand. So this would basically just repeal the prohibition that existed
yes.
before.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But replace it with these two sideboards.
No,
it's just to, like, justify why we're repealing it.
By virtue of it being in the minutes. It's a policy you can refer back to.
Ready for a second, I guess.
I seconded, but so are those two sideboards, those are not part of what we're adopting, right? We're just repealing?
At this point, the motion is to just repeal.
The motion is to, yeah. So it's been approved and seconded now for discussion, so I guess the discussion is to just repeal this entire prohibition on lobbying by agency staff.
Wait a minute. The motion I made that I thought was to replace what we had with this.
sorry, Doug, just to clarify, so what this is, what I'm talking about with F4B, it's my understanding that this is just an explanation on why the policy should be repealed. So it's just explaining why the policy should be repealed. I think the discussion is, do we want to make point the bullet, basically, into some sort of, like, policy? Because I don't read this as a policy, Tom, unless I'm misreading this.
That is correct. All I was trying to do was to give an explanation as to why the current policy was inappropriate.
Should be repealed.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I misunderstood, again, because I don't have it in front of me, I apologize, I misunderstood. So I will clarify my motion that I make a motion to repeal the previous lobbying regulations.
Is there a second?
I second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion?
My only discussion would be, after we do this, do we need to have Tom draft some new language, or do we just not need any language?
I don't think we need new language. I'm comfortable with just repealing.
Yeah, I guess I'm also comfortable appealing simply because the board works, or the DCPL staff work on behalf of the board. And so we will have bigger problems if they're doing something on the side that we have to, like, discuss. So I think that's exactly the purpose of staff, is to work on behalf of the board. So I don't think we need to have anything additionally outlined.
Okay. And again, I trust the staff. In the past, some board members did not, but I think the three of us do. And I would comment that if anything were to arise where there were problems, we can revisit this.
Just so the board knows, these two bullet points are something that I try very hard to make sure that I've communicated with staff members on any issue, whether it's controversial or not. And so this is something that I try to make sure that everyone understands here, that if you're going to be saying anything, you have to make sure that you are saying, this is not, I'm not speaking for the board. This is a personal opinion. So.
Okay, so it's been moved and seconded. Is there any other discussion on repealing the lobbying statute or lobbying policy currently on staff? See no additional discussion. All those in favor of repealing the lobbying policy, say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Josh.
Hi, Sarah. So the lobbying policy is repealed. All right. So that's done with old business. Now we're moving into routine business. So, Rich, you have...
Can we make a comment on that first?
Great.
Up until now, this is Jonathan speaking, we've had the executive secretary's report include the transaction reports and the details from finance and investments. It seemed to me, and I brought it up in the last investment committee, that it's unnecessary for that to be filtered through me. When you can get it right from the horse's mouth, if you will, from the investments, the chief investment officer. So the Tom and I and now Sarah and Rich are all involved with the development of the policies, and we're all in tune to it. But I think Rich is going to be more able to efficiently explain it to the board. And so that's why this has changed a little bit. I think we'll be doing this probably once a month.
I think that's probably adequate. If the board would like to have a report at every meeting, that's something that we could do also.
Thank you.
I just would like to point out to the written documents provided in the packet, but then I have a few things that I would like to point out. Diversification is going to be the overall goal for 2019. Now that the smoothing fund has been filled, we have the ability to move forward with increasing our expected long-term rate of return, along with increasing the annual distribution to beneficiaries. Rest assured, we'll be doing this in a very prudent manner. You know, for example, you know, we currently have a 15% target allocation to public equities, and throughout 2018, we made purchases that brought the portfolio about one-third of the way to that target. However, in the past 2 months, equities have surged nearly 20%. In response, we have slowed our pace of acquisitions, believing that we might be able to acquire these same assets at a lower price in the future. We are patient investors, and we should be patient because we have a long time horizon for this fund. In fixed income, a drop in market interest rates allowed us to sell $38 million in lower yielding bonds for a slight profit. The bonds we sold had an average yield of 3.38%, and we believe that we can do better by reinvesting these funds in other assets. The State Trust Fund Loan Program is entering an important time of the year. BCPL loans require annual payments of principal and interest on March 15th each year, and we expect about $64 million in principal to be returned to the funds over the next 10 days, which will increase our total cash reserves to about $100 million. These funds will remain in cash until needed for the loan program or selective bond purchases, or we make commitments to other assets. The investment committee is now meeting with real estate asset managers and venture capital firms to explore current opportunities in those markets. The Common School Fund has a target allocation of 5% to real estate, about $55 million, and we have not yet made a commitment to that asset class. However, if we do not find a compelling investment, cash is not a terrible place to be right now. The state investment fund is paying about 2.45%, not bad considering it paid zero for many years following the recession. Cash provides flexibility, which might prove valuable in these volatile markets. That's all I have for you this month. Does anybody have any questions?
This is Doug. I have
the report. Go ahead, Doug.
This is Doug. I have a question, sort of a little off topic. Remind me how we're doing with getting our unclaimed property money.
I guess I'll let Tom and Jonathan talk about that.
I don't have the most current report, but our view of it, Doug, is that it's this year is a pretty good return. Was it $34 million, I believe?
The tough thing about answering that question, Doug, is that
we
get that money once a year. It comes in the first week of September, generally. And so I do not have an estimate today as to what...
So pardon me, for who decided we get it once a year? I mean, it would be beneficial to us to get it once every quarter or something like that.
It would be. The Department of Revenue were the ones that decided on the once a year, and they came up with the...
So it's not in the statutes?
No.
So is there any reason why I couldn't suggest that we, the board, empower you to negotiate with them to get it on a quarterly basis?
They have some lumps in there, just their receipts.
They do have some unusual time frames that they deal with. So on an annual basis, all holder reports are due November 1st, which means that if you're a bank or something like that and you have some abandoned accounts, you have to notify the state on November 1st and turn that money over to the state. And so the folks over at Revenue are most flush with that money in early November, and then throughout the rest of the year, they are paying claims. I have not had a chance to talk to new administrators of the fund to determine whether or not there are other points in the year that may be more appropriate for sending over deposits.
This is Sarah. Doug, I think that's an interesting point because it just gives us potentially more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe a next step for us is to connect with Secretary Barca on this. I've already had conversations with Secretary Barca on unclaimed property, so I think following up with him on this is something that he would be open to and I think willing to work with us on what makes sense, so at least it's more than a once-a-year distribution. I don't know if quarterly, but I think at least more than once a year would give us assets sooner to invest in or just do whatever is in the best interest of our beneficiaries. So I'm willing to take that as an action item for us to work through.
Could I add one thing?
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you.
Doug, I'd like to add one thought to this. That is that we don't know at this point what the effect of the legislature's adoption of a law last year that eliminated third-party audits. Those third-party audits were where you found out where the money was, and now that there are no third-party audits and apparently no enforcement, it's reasonable to expect that the amount of money coming in from that line will decline. We have yet to see that, and it will perhaps become evident for the first time this November. But last November, or the distribution when it came out, I forget when it came out, Tom, was an upper because of the changed policies. We're kind of catching up with them. We're not confident it's going to continue at that high level.
So, and Doug, just to chime in on that too, and Jonathan, thanks for pointing that out, is there are there is one statute associated with my office with regard to unclaimed property that, depending on potentially a legal interpretation, that we could actually audit unclaimed property because I am responsible for promoting. It's hard for me to promote if I don't know what is in and actually a part of the fund. And so we have sought out legal support from the AG on some of our statutes, and so hopefully we'll have clarification on some of that too.
So this is Doug. Does that mean both, I guess, Tom and Sarah, and maybe Josh as well, is there some way that you could use that to get around the elimination of this audit? We opposed that elimination, but
yes.
We didn't succeed.
You mean the third-party audit, yes.
Yes, and I've asked for legal counsel on a few of my statutes. This would be one of them that would be associated with that.
Okay, well, if you could start doing the audits, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Well, it's hard to do when you're taking away the law.
Well, I mean, it goes back to, like, what's in our – I guess the point is that there might be a way for us to kind of be connected to that. So we're looking at that.
But I can say that the last administration, and I was on good terms with Rick Chandler, good person, they were very nervous about any audit of unclaimed property.
I know.
And it's potentially something that's reasonable to do because – it was shifted from the Treasurer's Office to Revenue, what, 5 years ago now?
Less
six? And there's been no reckoning of how it was before or after.
Right. So I think that there are potential opportunities to explore that from our office. Any other questions, I guess, with regards to the update from the Chief Investment Officer? I just want to actually thank Rich for doing this because I think this is really helpful. Granted, this has only been, our third meeting, but this report is really thorough, and just I think you providing that insight is a good best practice for us moving forward. Just a quick question is, our cash is getting a 2.54?
4.5. I just got the report this morning from the State Investment Fund, and they're payment on the state investment fund for the previous month was reported to be 2.45%.
And do we bank with the same bank that the state does, U.S. Bank, or do we have our own banking agreement?
We bank through the state's contract, and so we don't have a separate account at U.S. Bank.
Okay. Are we required to bank through them, or that's just for convenience and protection?
We are not required to bank with them. And, in fact, there have been times when we have moved significant portions of our liquid assets to accounts through American Deposit Management, ADM.
Right.
We have moved $40 million to ADM. It's just that for us to then pay expenses or
mm-hmm.
purchase other investments, the state controller's office goes through U.S. Bank, and so it would require us to move money back into that to be able to.
So I think it might be difficult to move our banking operations, but we do have the ability to move our short-term investments, which is what we have at the state investment fund, to anywhere that a fiduciary would have those investments. It just so happens that the State Investment Fund provides us with extremely excellent liquidity, next day liquidity, which is unusual in the market, and also provides us with a reasonable rate of return. Now, when we did move some of those funds to ADM about 2 years ago, the difference between what ADM was able to offer us in a return and the State Investment Fund was much greater. And so it made sense for us to move those funds. But in the meantime, the returns have equalized, and so now because of the additional liquidity offered by the State Investment Fund, it makes sense to keep our funds there unless we find some other alternative.
This is Doug. I have a question. If we're done with that, Sarah, are you finished? I'm sorry.
No, I guess the reason why I brought this up is that the state is actually negotiating or going through the RFP for the banking contract,
mm-hmm.
and knowing that we are a customer, I want to make sure that if it's necessary or appropriate for us to have a voice in that process. So that's why I was asking, is knowing that banking is a critical part of our operations,
mm-hmm.
with a $1.2 billion fund, I just want to make sure that we have a voice as we are looking at the banking contract and like what that can provide to our beneficiaries.
If you look within the State Investment Fund, everybody that's got an account there is listed on a report that's issued, the report that Rich was referring to, and BCPL is one of the largest accounts that's in there. I would say we are top 10
mm-hmm.
within there. And so not only are we one of the top, and we're positive, so not only do we have one of the largest accounts, but we are probably one of the more active ones because of the fact that we have investments that are coming in, we have money that's coming in, we have investments and expenses going out.
Some years the only larger one is the university.
So,
and we have not had a voice in this process, knowing that we're one of the largest accounts into this.
No. One of the things that's been nice about the relationship as it currently exists is we do not pay a separate fee for wire transfers in or out,
mm-hmm.
which is...
Yeah, I know.
A wonderful benefit. We do pay a fee every year for financial services to DOA, and supposedly a lot of things are wrapped into there. But considering the activity in our funds and the amount of wire transfers that we have, overall I think we've actually been getting a pretty good deal on this.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just asking, knowing that we don't know who the next bank is going to be.
Exactly.
Do we want a voice on that committee as they're reviewing, or do we want to put in things that we believe are really important? Because I do think that we have leverage being one of the largest
mm-hmm.
accounts, and I think to your point, Rich, also a positive balance, so that works well for the cash accounts for the state. But I want to make sure that if we want that, we have that. And so I'm asking, I mean, a $1.2 billion fund is not chunk change, and I want to make sure we're getting the best deal, because banking can actually be a big impact if we're not doing it to the benefit of the fund. So,
I agree. I do not know the answer to that. You know, I think that it's something that we should explore. I think that the State Investment Fund has been a good place for us to park our money, and it is very convenient. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't explore our alternatives. We have done that in the past, and we should always know what our alternatives are for short-term.
A couple of years ago, we might have had $200 million in the state SIF because of the paucity of investment options. Today, where are we at, 50 to 80?
Well, today we're at much less than that, but on March 15th we'll have somebody in there. One thing to consider is that the settlement time for investment transactions has been reduced, and for treasuries it's the next day. For municipal bonds and stocks it's T+2 now, and so that additional liquidity that is afforded by the State Investment Fund plays a more important role today.
Right. So if it's okay with, I guess, the board, my recommendation is going to be that we just move this banking conversation to the investment committee, and then we can pursue it there. But I know that it's in motion, so I just want us to decide what our actions are.
Yep.
Does that work with the board?
Okay.
Great.
Yeah, I guess. Do we have any reason to think that, who is, I guess, in charge of this process currently?
So the Department of Administration runs the banking contract. It's now up for a recompete slash they're looking at potential other vendors, and they want to make, I think, that decision by the end of May is what I've last heard. So I just want to make sure as they are looking at their options and what's really important versus what's not, as the one of the largest accounts, that we have a voice in that process.
I would expect that the State Investment Fund, which is run by the State Investment Board, would be maintained regardless of who the operating banking relationship is with.
Yes.
Okay, this is Doug. I have a question for Sarah.
Yes. I just want to make, Josh, did that answer your question before I move on to Doug?
It does. I guess the follow-up question I have I presume that they have expertise at DOA in doing that. Has VCCL been involved in the process before?
They do, Josh, but I will tell you, as somebody who has been getting more and more involved now with the state's financial operations, I think asking questions have, like, brought up different things that people have not thought about, and so I just think this is another strong avenue for us to be advocating for our beneficiaries, because banking can be a big part of a successful investment fund management practice. So I just want to make sure we're getting the best banking practices, or we're getting the best banking options possible.
Could I ask a question? I'd like to ask a question. Is there any differential?
Yeah, I mean, making sure that the state is getting the best banking options possible, obviously, is a good thing. So if you think it's helpful, Sarah, in your judgment to follow up on that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and because we're one of the largest accounts, I think it's fair for us to ask these questions and just make sure. So, okay, Doug.
My question is, when you were preparing your budget and discussing your budget with the governor's office, did you consider or make any discussion about returning unclaimed property to the treasurer?
I did, Doug, and I'm happy actually offline to talk with you about my budget. I think you and I can share.
Well, no, I mean, I don't care to talk about your budget now if you don't want to. My only question is, because it affects the board in terms of getting unclaimed property, I just wonder whether there was any discussion of returning that from revenue back to the treasurer.
So just to give a quick point of information, it was not included in the governor's budget. As we are suspecting, the legislature is going to start from a zero base anyway, so we'll be back to the negotiation block with the legislature, and then they'll go back to the governor where they will there figure it out again.
Okay. Well, in the future, we might consider trying to get that changed. But okay, for now. Thank you. Agreed.
Thanks, Doug. If there's no other questions with the Chief Investment Officer report, thank you, Rich. I'm just going to move to Jonathan and his Executive Secretary report.
I'm going to be very, very brief. The only thing I want to mention right now is that we're going to have our freshman orientation for freshman new incoming legislators. 15 assembly persons and one state senator, and that's going to be on March 27th at 8:30 in room 330 southwest of the Capitol, and an invitation is going out this week. The point that we like to make to these new legislators is introduce ourselves. We're going to, in that invitation, show them the totality of the loans that have been made in their assembly district in the last 5 or 10 years. And we're also going to show them the library aid distributions that have occurred in their district, and that should serve to get their attention. Gary Glecky's helping on that, by the way.
Sounds good. Thank you for doing that. That's important. Thank
yep.
you.
You, the board would be invited to that, of course, Doug. I would expect that the board chair, Sarah, would make a presentation or introduction at that meeting.
I'm absolutely planning on making at least an introduction, Jonathan. So whatever we think is best, but yeah, we can talk about it. Any questions to the executive secretary? Seeing none, we're just going to future agenda items. Doug and Josh, any feedback on future agenda items?
Not I.
Not for me either.
So just one thing I want to point out that we've had conversations about with regard to additional agenda items is actually additional revenue generation opportunities. One of the things that I did last week is I had a call with and connected with a couple of Western states about how they are potentially identifying additional revenue options on their public school trust lands. We know right now our primary form of revenue from these lands is timber, which is great, but we know that there might be other ways in which we can generate revenue for schools. I had a very good conversation, and what the recommendation was, and I think that there's some merit, is that we do a U.S. wildlife ecological assessment, which is free by the federal government. That then determines what's on our land with regard to unique ecological features, birds, and for example, New Mexico, just off of one bird, made $250,000 because they built a little bird platform and identified and reached out to all the international birders. And I think we could potentially do the same. And so I think it's important for us to kind of be thinking about these other opportunities and raising money for, again, public schools using our great school trust lands.
But I don't think we can charge people from coming on our land to look at birds.
Technically, we could. There is no state statute that requires our lands to be open to the public. It's just been a board policy for many years.
Oh, okay. The policy's been around so long, I thought it was sort of set in stone. I think it would be controversial for us to start telling people that they had to pay to come to walk on public land, but we can discuss that later.
Doug, I think there's some opportunity here, believe it or not, to obtain some grant funding to improve habitat, to develop a greater opportunity to visualize certain wildlife in an area, and then having some kind of public contribution tied with that would probably not be controversial.
Okay, we'll see. I know so far, Sarah, the only thing we've done, we've charged snowmobilers for trails, and we have long-term payments for those, right, Tom?
Yeah, we do have land use permits to snowmobile clubs, but those payments, I think, have been relatively nominal.
I agree. I wanted to charge more, but I didn't succeed at that.
Yeah, and the reason why I bring this up is because Outdoor Rec is a number one attraction for people to come to Wisconsin, and it is a huge revenue generation opportunity. And so other states have been using their school trust land that has been providing an alternative form of revenue that has been worthwhile, and I don't want Wisconsin to fall behind. And so I think it's worthwhile for us to potentially look at this opportunity to see if it's a good fit for us.
Tom?
Yes.
Sarah's got me thinking. Do we allow hunting on our land?
Yes, we do.
Doug, we actually advertise that our land is open to hunting.
Can we charge them for that?
No. Our lands are open to hunting. We do not have a special charge or special license or special permit required at all.
Well, but I'm saying, could we?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That would be controversial.
I think before, I don't want to put the cart before the horse. I think what I was trying to point out is two things. One is there are other opportunities to think about revenue generation with regards to our 77,000 acres of land. And I think the second thing is it might be worthwhile to do a free ecological assessment by the U.S. Wildlife Department. To understand what is on our lands, because I believe the last time we did something through the DNR was over a decade, and we know because of climate change that things have potentially changed. So that's why I bring this up.
So I have to get going. So are you asking the board to to approve the idea of having that assessment done, or do we need to do that?
No, no, no. I'm just putting it out as a future agenda item.
Well, if it's free, unless Tom or Jonathan have some objection, why don't we go ahead and do it?
The only concern I have is if someone else is doing the assessment, I'm not sure what kind of other limitations come with that. When we did the assessment that ended in 2004, I believe, it was our assessment, it was our information, and we could choose to do whatever we want with it. If an outside party does the assessment, I don't know what happens with that information. There have been times when other groups have come on our lands and said that they thought that certain species were there, and as a result, they asked us to shut down all timber activities until they could make a further determination.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's one of the ramifications that could come with this. So,
but, Tom, you think we can, like, look into it and negotiate or talk to them about it? Right?
I already reached out to the guys up north and asked for them to
okay.
think about this and get back to me with their thoughts and opinions
Great.
On it. So.
Okay.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, any other future agenda items? All right, seeing none, is there a motion to adjourn?
I move to adjourn. Doug?
I second.
Great, it's been moved and seconded. The meeting's adjourned. Thanks, everybody. Happy Tuesday.
All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye. Thanks, bye-bye.